hour number two on historic radio program for you tonight with Jim Mars, Harry Cooper, and remote viewer Dick Allgaier. The first hour was really fascinating, and I want again point you to the top piece of art at Rents. Look there, you'll see a poster for one of the most remarkable documentaries you'll ever see, the remote viewing of the death of Adolf Hitler. Just like Jim Marr's book on the JFK assassination, Crossfire, the definitive book on the Kennedy murder, and how David John Oates came in with his technology of reverse speech with Intel, which, by the way, in the intelligence agencies are well aware of that, and we think they're using it all the time. He came in and reversed so many of the principles of the JFK murder, from J. Edgar Hoover to Lee Harvey Oswald, Jack Ruby, everybody in between. And there is no question that that further validated what Jim has been putting together and researching for 52 years. And we're doing the same thing tonight with Harry Cooper's book about the real death of Adolf Hitler in Argentina, with this time not reverse speech, but remote viewing. So it's an extraordinary set of circumstances. All right, anything you want to add, Harry and Jim, before we jump into this with Dick? Harry, you first.
Just, I'm learning. I'm learning. And as you know, there's probably nobody in the world knows more about Hitler's escape to Argentina than I do, and that's not patting myself on the back.
No, it's the truth.
Yeah. I've been there five times. I just got back, as you know, I just got back from South America, where I visited Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil.
Yeah.
And I'm piecing all this information together that I'm getting from all the people who actually know a piece of the puzzle.
Well, this remote viewing session really underscores the truth of your book, the reality of the story that Don Angel reported to you. He didn't want to take that with him, obviously, and giving it to you was just an extraordinary event. Jim, anything to pop in here?
Well, for Harry, I'd like to say that I wish I had the time and money to accompany you to Antarctica, because I'd love to go down there and locate Agartha, the Shangri-La that they talked about, that they were preparing for the Fuhrer.
I think we are able to put this together extremely well. There's things I can't divulge right now. I'm going over to Europe again to about 3-4 weeks from now. But in addition, one of our members is a wonderful, wonderful guy, retired Captain U.S. Navy. He was the executive officer on the submarine that was down there. And I just got an email from him about an hour before airtime. Talks about a warm water lake that they went into with the Senate, etc. So I have to go through it further. But, it's just not all Harry Cooper doing this. Harry Cooper is merely the glue that holds all these people together, and they all have a piece of the puzzle. And it's just incredible when you start opening all the doors.
Well, one of the doors
this is nothing new. This goes back to 1938, when there was a huge German expedition that went down to Antarctica.
I sent you that video, didn't I, Jim? You got it, didn't you?
I think so.
Yeah, you got to look at that.
They planted all the flags.
Yeah, but they show still pictures of some of these, and I mean gigantic caverns underground. They're just huge.
Well, bear in mind, I went to that island off of Rio, about 1,000 clicks out in the Atlantic, South Atlantic there, the island Trindade, not to be confused with Trinidad. And this is where that expedition laid over for a while. That island is owned by Brazil, and they've had a naval contingent there forever. Mm-hmm. And their whole job is to raise the flag in the morning and say, we own 200 miles of fishing around here, and retire the colors at night. It's not a military garrison like you would imagine, guns and stuff. No, it's just people there and doing some experiments. So 1938, the Brazil Navy pulled all their people off the island, and 1 week later, the expedition under the flagship Schwabenland arrived. They built, look at the website, sharkhunters.com, and go to previous tours, and then click Brazil. They built two 80-meter-tall radio towers. I was in the remains of one of the radio shacks, And then in 1941, the Germans pulled their people off. The Brazil Navy put their people back on. There's a little memorial. There's a picture of that little memorial. It's a handmade memorial, a painted rock with other painted rocks that spell out 1941. Then in 1945, July, the Brazil Navy pulled their people off the island again, and a German contingent came down. This is 3 months after the war ended. One of the German sailors was killed in an accident, and we found this giant rock that had 717 painted on it, weathered all to heck, and we assumed that meant he was killed on the 17th of July. This island was instrumental because it just loaded with freshwater streams and creeks, and it had large herds of pigs and goats and wild turtles. So when a ship would come by on its way to Argentina, they could pull in there, refill their fresh water, and in the mafia days, they would clip a bunch of pigs and butcher them. I'm sorry, that's the word. And then continue. And the Germans were there at least 2 years after the war ended, we know for sure.
Wow. Well, hey, Harry, with that installation, wouldn't that have been a perfect retransmission station to transmit messages from Europe through there on into Antarctica?
I can't imagine any other reason for them 80-meter-tall radio towers. There's pictures of them on my website, too.
Yeah, when we've been on tour with Harry in the past on these expeditions, we've seen so many photographs, and they're all in the archives. You can find them all at sharkhunters.com, too. Okay, let's jump over to Dick now and tell us what we're going to see on this really remarkable documentary production that I was very honored to be able to participate in.
Well, we see me describing the death in the bunker, someone actually getting shot. But if you want to see what goes through a remote viewer's mind, you can watch that clip, and something is not right about it. I keep saying that it's an act. It's a drama. I got the sense that someone was really killed, but someone wasn't right about it. It was play acting. It was a real death, but it was there as a staged thing, which makes sense. I also perceived that there was a delegation came. There was some meeting. People met. Some agreement was made, and a leader was told, the guy in charge was told, well, you're going to do this, and he wasn't happy about it. So here's my question for Harry Cooper and for Jim Mars. If we believe that Hitler was allowed to escape, was he allowed or was he given safe passage? Was technology transferred? Was there a formal agreement? How did this happen? Did he just scoot away without the Allies knowing it, and then they just agreed to not chase him? Or did a delegation go and they made a formal face-to-face agreement in the middle of the war?
A trade for technology. Trade for technology. Yeah, how did it work? Yeah.
Did they meet face-to-face?
A TV journalist, because you asked about 43 questions there in one question. according to Don Angel, Hitler and Eva Braun were forcibly drugged because Bormann wanted to keep the Reich alive, which he did, but he needed a figurehead. But once they got down to Argentina, he found he didn't need Hitler, so Hitler was just allowed to live out his life quietly in Bariloche, which incidentally has been visited by four different presidents, American presidents, during their presidency that we know of for sure: Eisenhower, Carter, Clinton, and just recently Mr. Potato.
They might as well have gone to Antarctica. I mean, that's just out of the way. What's the reason that Eisenhower would have gone to Bariloche in 54 or 60, whenever he went?
1960.
60.
Yeah, so according to Don Angel, this is what happened. Now, we know that the only operating Ju-390, the big six-engine, the one they called the truck, we know it was at the air base of Schweidnitz, which I think was on the border of Romania. It flew out, and it went to Norway, which was the only part of the German forces that had not been conquered, and they were just, the war was over, so they were just waiting for the Brits or the Americans or somebody to come and scoop them up, which took 3 months. And so the plane landed there. It was painted in Swedish Air Force colors, light blue, and it flew down nonstop. This thing had an incredible range. Flew down nonstop and landed on a road or on an estancia, a ranch, in Uruguay, and was immediately disassembled and the parts all thrown away. When I was there just this past February, we were interviewing a lot of old people that lived there, Germans. I don't speak Spanish, but I get along fine and with my German down there. And this lady was sitting there, older lady. She doesn't know anything. She heard about it. She doesn't know nothing. But no, there was no Nazis down here. And the lady had three swastikas tattooed on her forearm. So that's how he got down there. And then he went to live in Bariloche, which is a beautiful place. But we can go, you know, we can use up another two whole hours on that.
Yeah, on the cover of Harry's book is a color photograph of the beautiful home, Bavarian style, built by the Mercedes family in Bariloche that Hitler apparently
that
lived
photo
in.
And, we got to thank Jeff for helping design that cover.
Oh.
That story of Don Angel telling about being on the U-boat with Martin Bormann was one of the best stories I've ever read. I read that book, and that is just about being in that cramped, stinky U-boat, and Don Angel didn't like being in U-boats, and Martin Bormann was not a nice guy. There are just touches in there that you can just tell it. He's telling the, it's a real story. There's so much detail. It's a great story.
Yeah, he got along with Bormann as much as he had to, but like you say, Bormann was hard to get along with, and that one exchange where the captain of the U-boat got angry with Don Angel and gave him an ass chewing, and then Bormann stood him up and reminded him that if he insulted Don Angel again, it would be the same as insulting the leader of the Third Reich, which was Bormann at that time, and he said, "Do I need to remind you of the consequences of insulting the Führer?"
Wow.
Which I think meant Schutzky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
quite a story.
It was an interesting book to work on. I loved every minute of it, and the thing I like about it most, it's absolutely accurate, right on the button.
Indeed.
Harry, what do you know about the exchange of nuclear technology? In the documentary, we interviewed Jim about that, and he can speak about it. And I think Jim just found some new information about the Germans being farther along with their atomic bombs. But is that what the reason I asked this in my session? I'm doing this work over weeks. And it's like going into a movie fourplex, going into one movie and then going into the other and going into the other, and you don't, you're looking at it through fogged goggles. Like, what is this? Why is this? Yeah. At one point, I said, well, there's something to do with old nuclear technology, people with slide rules, and they're trading, it's a spy exchange for nuclear secrets. Do you have information, Harry, about them giving nuclear secrets or nuclear material in exchange for top leaders being allowed to skedaddle out of there?
Is the Pope Catholic? okay. This we cannot say that I have proof, but we can say that it's a theory that is so rock solid. And the reason I can say that, my career field in the Air Force was SPECWEPS. And in January until June of 1958, only a short time after the war ended, I was in intensive training for nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. And in the first week or two of our training, we saw films of the early U.S. atomic energy program, and we were having a lot of trouble. We were running short of fissionable material, and one of our members, member number 25, whose name escapes me, Bob Wilcox, he wrote a book in 1984 called Japan's Secret War, and in that book he shows that Japan test-fired their first nuclear device 1 week before the U.S. We were having trouble with the triggers. Now, to achieve a nuclear explosion, you have a ball of uranium about the size of a grapefruit, and it's surrounded with 64 shaped charges that have to detonate at the exact same millimicrosecond to crush in and squeeze this grapefruit-sized ball of uranium and make it supercritical, and then you've got your nuclear blast. And they were having trouble figuring out how to make this work. Well, then the war ended, and within weeks after the war ended, our scientists got brilliant. We had lots of uranium, and we had the technology to make the triggers.
It was a gift from God. That's what it was.
Well, I don't know from God, but it was a gift. And we found out later, Dr. Heinz Schlicke, who became a member of Shark Hunters later, he was on board that submarine U-234, which was on its way to Tokyo. It had 560 kilos of uranium on board, uranium oxide, and according to a source of ours, it also had some weapons-grade uranium on board. It also had a bunch of scientists. It had a Luftwaffe lieutenant general and two Japanese officers and an ME-262 jet fighter in crates with all the documentation for the Japanese to start production. Well, they got the surrender order when they were in the North Atlantic, so they surrendered to the U.S., and suddenly, like I say, our scientists got real smart, and we found out later Dr. Schlicke was the guy who designed the infrared trigger devices for these 64-shaped charges, which were made out of Comp B and Baritol, which is not important, but there's no hard proof. There's no document that said, yep, this is what happened. However, to a sensible human being, the war ended, we got a ton of technology, and certain Germans were allowed to get out of Dodge without being interrupted. So, you know, 2 + 2 = 4.
Understand that we not only got nuclear technology, we also got rocketry. The Germans were NASA. They took us to the moon. They took us to space. And their heritage is still there.
The first director of NASA was Dr. Davis.
Dr. Davis, that's right. It's all there. It's a who's who of German brilliant science. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think the people on, even all the people on board, there were a couple of Japanese officers there, and when they found out that they were going to be turned over to the Americans, as I understand it, they committed suicide.
By the old traditional method of harikiri. They just took large doses of phenobarbital and rolled around in their bunks whining and complaining for almost a full day while nobody could help them because they were under heavy weather.
Yeah.
And their bodies were not stuck under the floorboards like some rumors say. I knew the skipper of U-234. I spent a whole day with him in his home in Hamburg many, many years ago. He said they were tied up inside the canvas shroud, and they were given a military funeral, a Navy funeral, under a Japanese flag, and they had given their samurai swords to Captain Fowler. So, you know,
Let me ask you this, Harry. Since you talked to the captain, did he have any foreknowledge? Was he under any kind of orders to meet a specific ship or some specific Americans to turn over, or did he just act on his own, or do you know?
Yeah, I know. I know what he told me, and I have to believe him. He said that when they were in the North Atlantic and they were going to go down the African coast and around Cape of Good Hope and into the Indian Ocean and across to Japan, When they were there, they received the surrender order, and a lot of that is in our follow-on book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance.
Right. Well, and, my point being is that you know, towards the end of the war, starting about mid 1944. Well, actually, I'm pretty well pinpointed. It was after the breakout at St. Lo, after the Normandy beachhead. Everybody knew the game was up. Okay, it was just a matter of time before the Allies would take over Germany, and that's when there was a meeting with Morton Bormann, who was a deputy to Hitler, Hermann Schmitz, who was the head of IG Farben, and Dr. Hermann Joseph Obst, who was head of the German Central Bank, and they initiated Operation Eagle Flight, Adlerflug, and that was part of an overall plan called Innerhandel. And what they did was, there was already about 1,000 German corporations around the world that all had tie-ins with Standard Oil, IBM, Ford, ITT.
And they created Farben Industry was in bed with Standard Oil.
Oh, absolutely. At the top, at that level, that's where they was all tied together. Now, they created another 750 corporations. This was the Reich continuing under corporate auspices. But anyway, my point is that I think Morton Bormann and these guys pretty well took over by the fall of 1944, and that's why they're in after 45. That's why he was the one that took charge and drugged Hitler and Eva and smuggled them off to South America. And I think the deal was cut to take into captivity the submarine, because you mentioned Dr. Schlichter, which is absolutely true. One of the problems we were having with a nuclear bomb is that, number one, we were trying to enrich uranium by centrifuge, which is a slow, tedious process. And in early 1945, Roosevelt was appraised of the fact that we really only had enough enriched uranium for one bomb. And the other problem we had was we didn't have fuses that were fast enough to trigger a nuclear explosion. So when they captured the U-234, guess what's on board, in addition to everything you mentioned? 50 goal line casks of uranium, okay? Yep. And of course, Dr. Schlichter and his speedy fuses. And again, I'm with you, and you're absolutely right. You know, there's no absolute proof of all this, but anyone with common sense, all you have to do is just look at the time frame. Of everything that happened. For example, we have the after being told that we didn't have enough uranium and we didn't have the fuse, on May the 14th, 1945, we got the U-234 taken in captivity and with 560 kilograms of uranium. Okay, and then on July the 16th, so that's May, that's about a month later, they set off the first atomic bomb at the Trinity site in Alamogordo. And interestingly enough, that very same day, the USS Indianapolis departs San Francisco. Now, 10 days later, on July the 26th, the Indianapolis arrives at Tinian, and they piece together the bomb. On August the 6th, you know, just about a week later, they bomb Hiroshima, and then a few days later, they bomb Nagasaki. So where'd the second bomb come from? We only had enough for one. So, yeah. I mean, come on, folks. At some level, at some corporate multinational banking level, there was a deal cut, and we, under Operation Paperclip, we allowed all these top Nazis to escape. Thousands of them came over here. We rolled them into our military-industrial complex. We got their missiles. We got their aircraft. We got their jet fighters. We got their mind control. We got their fluoride that they put in the water of the concentration camps to keep the inmates placid and non-resistant. And they gave us their nuclear technology. Now, here's what's really amazing. Just today, I got a story about now they think that they have found the place where they think that they have found the place where up to 5 atomic bombs had been built by the Nazis, and they think they have now found it at what had been a Russian military training area in the Jonasdal Valley. Okay, and then they think that this is where it came from. The thing that really got me was the fact that they were saying that that the Nazis, you know, the reason I've always said that the Nazis, if they did develop a nuclear bomb, I think the reason they didn't use it was the fact that they didn't have a reliable delivery system, number one. They had the A-10 rocket, three-stage rocket, but they didn't really have a good guidance system. They couldn't count on it being accurate. Then they had those bombers that Harry mentioned up in Norway, but that base wasn't quite finished yet. In fact, when we finally took it over, the crews up there and everybody was talking about they were preparing for a New York mission. Hello. Yeah. I guess they decided they might try to drop a bomb on New York.
Right.
But in this story today, where they think they have found that at least that at least five nuclear bombs may have been manufactured there, it says it is rumored that the Nazis had moral objections using them due to the power of destruction and the long-lasting radiation. Now, think about that one for a minute, folks. The Nazis with moral objections? Come on. But I think that's absolutely what happened. And but obviously, we didn't have the moral objections, and we dropped the first two atomic bombs.
Harry, a quick question about the huge six-engine plane that took a very special group of people down to Uruguay.
Yeah, the KU-390.
Could the 390 have been built to carry a heavy nuclear bomb, an atomic bomb?
Well, just about any large aircraft can be turned into a passenger plane or a
strategic military weapon, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, it can be turned into a bomber. Yeah. But they only had three of these built, and the third one never even got finished. So, you know, they weren't going to get much done.
That the same plane that they flew within 25 miles of New York, or was that a different plane?
No, that's the
one that's alleged have come within 20 miles of New York.
That was the one, okay.
Yeah.
Turned around and came back over New York. Who was the woman in the plane? There was a woman pilot, too, or co-pilot.
That's correct. I forgot what her name was. Obviously not Hannah Reich, but I forgot the name of the lady. But we did have it in one issue of our magazine about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, I saw that, and I can't remember it either. Maybe I can find it.
Well, that's what happens, I guess, when we get old, eh, Jim?
It just happens
hey,
when
don't
you get
old. I just get better.
Too much. There you go. Too much information. All right, let's remind everyone what we're talking about here is a documentary by Dick Allgaier and his remote viewing of the death of Adolf Hitler. Now, Dick, let's concentrate a little bit on the documentary at this point. Tell people it's fascinating to watch you struggling with this target, and you're drawing things. You're saying there's a man. He's giving a speech. There's a really noisy crowd. They're going rah rah yeah that kind of thing. You had the whole energy there. Did you feel this physically? And then question two, you mentioned the smell of a hat. How common is it in remote viewing to have the olfactory sense come into play, the sense of smell and the sense of feeling? You were feeling this room full of people.
Yeah, it's different for different viewers, and it's different for me at different times. What I try to key off of is a visual. So I close my eyes, and I get a brief flash, and it's like black and white, sepia-toned, like looking through a fuzzy glass for just an instant. And then what happens is I've done so many viewings. I've been doing this for 18 years. You get a library of images. Like I can say, oh, that's a structure because I can see right angles. Or that's a group of people. I saw this guy with his arm up at like a podium, not clear enough to recognize it as Hitler. But you get a brief flash and then your mind fills it in. Like, oh, that's a guy at a podium on a stage and there's a lot of people there. I'm very good with sounds in terms of ideas. I don't hear the actual sounds, but the idea of a sound comes to me. smells are really good to me. I can get a smell, but I can't put a name to it. Like I described it as, we've all smelled a fedora, the inside of a hat that has a certain smell to it. That just that just came to me, the idea of a fedora. What really came to me real strong visually in this one, and I never identified it as Hitler. I never figured that out. But I saw a guy in a bed, and I knew it was his deathbed. So my question for Harry Cooper is, if I say I saw this man in dying in bed of natural causes, and I perceived that he was bitter, haggard, he felt double-crossed, he was just felt betrayed and bitter, and he was buried anonymously in a country cemetery, does that sound believable to you? Now, there may be some evidence that he was disinterred and something else happened, but would he have originally been buried anonymously out in the country, just a nice, I saw like a rolling hillside, an old lane, and a crumbling fence, and a bunch of grave markers. Does that sound like what you think happened or have heard happened to him?
You're putting me in a bumpy position here. One of our friends down there in Brazil who is about to release a book on some other people who allegedly were dead in the bunker who really were not. According to what his findings are, Hitler was buried in a country graveyard in Paraguay, and then disinterred and buried in a
another location.
I know you're trying to help me out here, Jeff, because you and I both know. But no, he was, according to this person, he was buried at a huge church in a town in Paraguay. Now that's not what we have, but I you know, where he is, I don't.
Well, okay, let's leave it for now.
Okay.
All right, Dick,
let me ask. The pilot you were asking about is Anna Kreisling. She was called the White Wolf of the Luftwaffe.
Very good. That's it, the White Wolf.
That's right. Yeah. Thanks for getting me out of a difficult spot there.
Thank you. Now, here, let me ask Dick. Hold on. Dick raised some very important things. How, Harry, would Hitler, and Jim, you can come in right after, how would Hitler have felt if Dick Allgaier's time-traveling remote viewing is correct, and being with that man or at the moment he was dying or the moments he was passing and feeling and sensing his betrayal, his bitterness, his brokenness inside. Does that fit with everything you know, Harry, about how he might have felt?
Yeah, we can only theorize at that point. He had been the most powerful man in the world at one point. He brought Germany out of a terrible depression. He was making Germany a fantastically great country again, and then all of a sudden he's shoved off into the back, on the back burner, so to speak, by Bormann. Bormann overpowered just about everybody, and I've been warned by a couple of our friends who are in the various intelligence agencies on their side, one of which doesn't even exist according to what we know. But it does, that Bormann set up more than 750 corporations, many of which are still in operation today, and they wouldn't want it known that Bormann helped them set it up. But the point is, Bormann overpowered everybody and took control. Hitler was just stuck off in a corner, here, have a nice time, and he moved out of Bariloche in about 1955 or 60, because the place was getting too popular with tourists. Beautiful area, big, huge lake for fishing, right at the foothills of the Andes for skiing, and we know Skorzeny was there skiing, and so was Rudel,
because Rudel worked for the Argentine Air Force for years after the war. But then when it got discovered, he had to move up to Cordoba and Mendoza province, and we've tracked him through there. But here he was, one of the most powerful men in the world, and suddenly here, just go live your life and be quiet. Don't cause any ripples. So maybe he was kind of bitter about it. I have nothing to say yes he was or no he wasn't. Just a guess.
Imagine the Jim, we'll hear from you next, but imagine the frustration. They just ran out of time. Another 6 months, another 12 months, and the whole thing might well have been 180 degrees different. Jim, what about this?
Well, the scenario I can see that fits with everything we know, everything I know anyway, and with Dick's remote viewing, is that, Dick, the sequence you talked about where somebody who obviously knew Hitler and came to him, and I don't think he used the term whisper in his ear, but he was there, and they had a private conversation, and that was apparently kind of the turning point. That's why in your remote viewing, I think you turned to that. In my scenario, I would say that was Bormann, his chief of staff, who, you know, had full access to him. In fact, that's how he got to be so powerful, is that acting as chief of staff, it was Bormann who could decide who talked to Hitler and who didn't, and what they told Hitler and what they didn't. And he was pretty well running the show, especially after the summer of 44. But I think it was Bormann who had made a deal at the highest levels of international banking and commerce, who then stepped to Hitler in a private conversation and said, "Mein Führer, you know, I'm sorry, but we're going to lose the war. And I think you need to start making preparations to leave." And Hitler probably said, "No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go down with the ship." And that's probably when Morton Bormann decided, "Well, we'll just whisk him out of here, drug him, and take him anyway." And I think the deal was cut at that level between possibly through Alan Dulles, possibly through John J. McCloy, who was CEO of National Citibank in the 30s, and they were the largest lenders of money to the Nazi government, and good friends with the head of ABS, head of the German Central Bank. And I think that at that level they said, "Okay, look, the war's going to be gone. Let's carve up Germany. We'll all get our fingers in the pie. And America needs we need the nuclear technology so we can end the war with Japan." And I think that's where the deal was cut. And they would tell Hitler, "Look, if you don't do this, all of Germany is going to be a wasteland, and you have to do it, Mein Führer." And I think that's what turned him. He felt betrayed. He felt bitter. And the thing that stuck with me, Dick, is when you said he knew he had to do this. He didn't want to do it, but he had to do it. Okay? So obviously there was extreme leverage on him. And I think that was it. It was either you go along with this or your beloved Germany will be totally destroyed.
And it damn near was, but... Yeah, very interesting.
Devastated, but it sure sprang back well.
Yeah, well, you said something. Harry Cooper said something. He said, here's this man, make Germany great again. Sounds like a familiar political statement, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. What goes around comes around.
Yeah. Well, Dick, tell our listeners more about this process and how you decided to film. You actually, and we could call it a state, a mental state, a psychic state, and you're shown in many scenes working in that state of mind at the board. I mean, it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, I do preliminary work on paper and pen before I go to the board, so I have an idea of where I'm going, but I kind of have to stand there, and there's lights and cameras, which I'm used to being on TV, so I'm pretty comfortable. I'm listening to theta tones in headsets that help put me and train me into that place.
Ah, so that's what those earplugs are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, while we're speaking about the state of mind of this guy that I was remote viewing, I've done a number of remote viewing sessions for law enforcement investigative agencies, and I've done missing persons and murders and that type of thing. So I have remote viewed psychopaths. I've remote viewed murderers. it's a scary thing. I've done a couple sessions. When you're remote viewing a person, you get so close to them that their thoughts start occurring in your head. So I did one session once that it was for a client. I didn't know who it was or what it was. And I started thinking the most ghastly things and using language that was just really foul, just awful swear words about some woman. I had somebody looking in a house and just thinking, horrid. And I was afraid to put it on paper, thinking, you know, this is not the way I think. And it turned out to be a stalker that was stalking this woman. And what was going through his mind was awful. I did a guy that was a missing woman up in the Northwest, and I witnessed the guy dumping her body, and what he was thinking when he was dragging her body to the river was just, it made me sick. It scared me. I came out of the session, and that those thoughts had been in my head. It's very disturbing. When I remote viewed this man for this project, I didn't get any of that. I don't think he was a psychopath. I don't think he was a mass murderer. He seemed like a guy that was conflicted in many ways, was put on he was brave, but something about him had a timidity. He was bold. He was, at the end of his life, broken, distrustful, bitter, and just how you'd imagine. But I didn't, you know, the person that passed it originally thought of, you know, the probing the mind of the world's worst mass murderer, and I didn't get any of that.
That
might get me in trouble with the people that Harry calls the, what do you call him, Harry?
Spit licker.
yeah. Well, I don't want to run afoul of them, but I...
Oh, you got what you got, Dick. You got what you got.
I got what I got. It was a legitimate remote viewing session. Yeah. I stand by it. So, yeah.
Well, that wouldn't actually... Anybody who I know who honestly looks at World War II history through clear and open eyes and fair-minded evaluations and looks at the events would probably come to, if they weren't overwhelmed with propaganda, probably come to the same general idea about the state of mind of Adolf Hitler. He was a man trying to do something, to live the impossible dream, to make a shattered and just beaten country once again respectable and alive and to flourish for its people and its culture. And that's probably what happened. The people under him, maybe they're horses of a different color entirely. You didn't look at them, though. You looked at the man, and that's what you got.
Yeah, it was interesting, you know, and this documentary almost never saw the light of day. It was going to be tossed, you know, just filed away, this data, but it was Jim Marsh helping out, and it was me reading. I heard Harry on your show, and I joined Shark Hunters, and I bought... Harry, I just bought another book, the one about the new book about the pilots.
When Eagles Soared.
Yep. I just bought that last week.
Look at Harry Cooper's name and guests. So look under his name, and you'll see a list of some of the fabulous books that Shark Hunters offers. These are real living history accounts told by the people who lived it. It's an extraordinary number of books.
If I can be so bold, if any of your listeners want to get a copy of our current magazine, they just have to send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and I'll send them the current magazine by email.
They're terrific publications. Terrific. Not a newsletter. This is a magazine kind of a thing, full of information. Yeah, go ahead, Dick.
I'm sorry. Harry, are you going to take a film video crew with you to Antarctica?
We have one hell of a mess of people, and the one we're talking to right now is another member of Shark Hunters, Monty Markham, who was a movie star back in the day, and he's got a big production company now, and he's talking about joining us down. Yeah, we're not looking at about a $5,000 or $6,000
deal that when I go to South America, it costs about $5,000 or $6,000, and thank God we've got an angel that sends us that money. But this, we're looking at probably $500,000. So it's going to be full tilt.
When we look at the bird expedition known as Operation High Jump,
then
we look at that film I finally found and got to you, and I also sent it to Jim, 1938-39 German expedition to Antarctica, and you look at some of the still pictures in there of these gigantic underground, not under the snow and ice, underground caverns. I mean, these things are huge. And you think about that, and you know what thought came to me, Harry?
What's that?
The thought was, wow, and then what didn't they show us that they found down there?
Yeah. And we have, you know, we've been told that it's very difficult to get, you know, get to places we need down there. But as you know, in my understanding of the German language, Ein Gang Verboten means Harry's welcome here.
That's right.
But we have already gotten the green light from several of the governing agencies down there. So we're not going to have any problem with the authorities. We're not going to have to outrun the police. We've been promised cooperation from several of these entities, and we've got stuff that I can't even mention just yet.
Right. If also, if anybody out there is listening who knows anyone who was involved with Operation High Jump, and there's some of those men are still alive. There are about 5,000 plus of them in Admiral Byrd's transports and his aircraft carrier and all that. They went down there and they met a very unpleasant welcome. And Operation High Jump, look it up, do your research, folks. It's Admiral Byrd got his tail kicked and he left. Something's down there, and I'm not sure that Harry Cooper will be able to find that, but he's going looking, and it may be time that be investigated fully. When you look at that film, I should post it again and look at the caverns there that are completely weather resistant. There are no icebergs inside these caverns, no frozen. They're habitable. And what could have been built there from 1938-39 to 1944-45, they could have sent a whole lot of transport ships down there with a whole lot of building material and done some remarkable things. All right, we got to wrap this up. Dick, what do you want to add here? As a final word or two, if I can point you again to the top of Rents.com, we're talking about the poster of the documentary. You see right there what happened, what really happened to Adolf Hitler, remote viewing the death of the Führer.
Yeah, I think it's one of the best remote viewing documentaries that honestly shows real remote viewing. It's Jeff Rentz helped write it and produce it. He's the narrator, and anything is good with Jim Mars in it, and Jim Mars providing commentary. The link is there, and I think it's worth watching. And it's just been so interesting to get feedback. As a remote viewer, you often crave feedback because you stand there and you don't know. I don't know why I wrote nuclear stuff. I don't know why I drew a guy anonymously buried in a, you know, and it's interesting for me to hear it from the guy who knows, and that's Harry Cooper. So it's been an interesting show. Thank you so much, guys, for helping out.
You got it. Harry, anything you want to add here? This is really an extraordinary subject, and I think we are now getting further confirmation of your long and dedicated work to bring historical truth to all of us.
It's been an interesting evening for me. I learned a lot, and I think shows like this where you have several people like Dick and Jim and myself to get point, counterpoint, and to embellish and to reinforce what each person has learned, I think this is one of your better shows.
Well, it's great because of you folks. And James, you've been watching this story, as it were, for a lot of years. This all, like the JFK with the reverse speech, it all kind of gels. It all flows together.
And it substantiates my little motto, okay, which is basically none of us are as smart as all of us. And so when you put remote viewing together with and Dick's remote viewing, and you put Harry Cooper together, who probably knows more intricate details about the U-boats, the Luftwaffe, the Third Reich, you take me, who's been studying this for more than 52 years, because even as a kid, I was interested in the war and was studying about whatever I could get my hands on about the Third Reich. And so it's really amazing how all this comes together.
It is. Thank you, gentlemen, all of you. Just a fabulous job, each. Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks,
okay.
Jeff. Have a good weekend, everybody.
All right.
Yeah, you guys too. Happy Friday the 13th.
Indeed. All right.
Yep.
Okay, that's our program, and it'll be in the archives, and I again draw your attention to the top art at Rents, what really happened to Adolf Hitler remote viewing the death of the Führer. Take a look. At least go look at the trailer. I think you will be most intrigued. And we will be right back.